problem of moving people's graveyards in order to build sewers for the rich people. So there was real social meaning behind it. And that's what I took into my stage show, my one-man show, and then into the CDs, which we made, and we incorporated songs into it. And that naturally went over into the television as well. So for me, yes, it comes from the Victorian Music Hall.
So that's in one sense, this genre has a long, long, long tradition going back into the 19th and perhaps
it goes back into the jongleurs of the Normans, the troubadours of the Middle Ages, probably the Viking saga singers and so on. Homer even. I don't know. It's forever. Mm. Everybody loves a good song which tells a story.
Aristophanes, I think, described satire as... partly he described it as... in song form, so obviously it goes back 2,500 years. Any song that's a success has usually got one big hook to it, whatever that hook might be. And really, in a sense, a comic song is no different, and the hook is usually just a very good gag, or it might just be four Georges, four blokes in a song. It's got to be a boy band. And that, once you establish your hook, then the other things sort of follow from that.
I mean, what I find wonderful about this stuff is I'm a historian of the Restoration. You know, if we write, we have footnotes. It's pretty dull reading at times. But that song, the Charles II rap, really, to me, captures the whole libertine sort of culture of the court of the Merry Monarch. And what I find compelling is how you've managed to sum up just a few epic moments in that history in a couple of lines. And I want to quote a bit. I can't do it in rhythm, but maybe. King Charles, my daddy, lost his throne. Kings were banned. They chopped off his head when Ollie Cromwell ruled the land. Old Ollie wasn't jolly. Lovely line. He was glum and he was proud and as miserable as sin, but sinning's not allowed. How hard is it to do that?
People say to me sometimes, oh, you write songs, and I actually... I think what I do is I write rhyming gags, really. And so I'm always just looking for stupid rhymes. And it's always nice to get an internal rhyme as well, like old Ollie wasn't jolly. You know, it's always quite satisfying. So you kind of just... It's a difficult process to explain because you're kind of looking for sort of four or five different things at the same time.
My name is Charles II. I love the people and the people love me so much that they restored the English monarchy. I'm part Scottish, French, Italian, a little bit Dane, but 100% party animal. Champagne! Spaniels I adored, named after me too. Like me, they were fun with a natty hairdo. Is today my birthday? I can't recall. Let's have a party anyway because I love a mothball.
Oh, hail the King of Bling. Let's sing, bells ring, ding ding.
I'm the king who brought back partying. King Charles, my daddy, lost his throne and kings were banned. He chopped off his head, then Ollie Cromwell ruled the land. Old Ollie wasn't jolly, he was glum and he was proud. Would be miserable as sin, only sinning's not allowed. When Ollie died, the people said, Charlie, me hearty, get rid of his dull laws, come back, we'd rather party. This action's what they called the monarchy restoration, which naturally was followed by a huge celebration.
The king of England,
no
sin to sin.
Okay.
Or anything.
All say, the king who brought back partying.
The most interesting thing for me with that song was that here's this guy who, among other things, had nine mistresses, and it was the first time I'd thought, this is an area now, how do you deal with this sort of information in a show that's aimed at sort of 8-year-olds? And so that was actually the hardest thing, was trying to make the story about the mistresses work in a way that could be told as information to 8-year-olds, but anyone who was older would kind of get what that was about. And that was really the hardest thing with that song.
I mean, I guess that's a broad approach of the books as well, though. You're communicating in quite a grown-up way with young children, young minds.
That's one of the things that, for me, Terry's approach is really important, because he takes children seriously and he says, you can deal with this, you can think about this for yourself, here's some information that grown-ups might not have thought to tell you or might not have thought to learn. And he really treats children like they've got brains, and that's certainly an approach that we found really useful, that we were able to treat them like they could take it and like they could join in a debate, and that they could... One of the things I really remember is Terry's books always say, well, that might be true, but it might not. Why don't you go and think about it for yourself? Why don't you go and make your own mind up? Why don't you go and talk to somebody about this? And that's what we wanted. We wanted children to take the information from the TV show and go and do their own research or go and make up their own minds. And that, for me, was really key. It's one of the key things about the attitudes of the books.
You sat down on the sofa, you're listening to music and learning songs at the same time. You're also having a laugh. I mean, you wouldn't have a laugh in a lesson your teacher's telling you.
Because usually you're sitting down in the classroom listening to your teacher telling you things, and it can be made quite boring very easily. However, with all the Horrible Histories TV, one of my history teachers did an experiment and they showed us a clip of Horrible Histories, and suddenly we learned so much more than in a usual history session, and all my classmates were very alert for the rest of the lesson, and we were full of information.
Children's literature had a lot to answer for because they always treated children like children. And then along came this wonderful man called Roald Dahl, who brought out these books which were black comedy. And people said, you can't do Charlie and the Chocolate Factory with people drowning in a puddle of chocolate. That's disgusting. And they refused to publish him, and he took about 7 or 8 goes before he was published. But once Dahl had broken down that barrier, I was able to follow up with the factual.
You've had a tremendous response from children to the series, but what is it that they really like best?
I always said I wanted to make a show that people would say was too good for children, because I thought that's what children deserved, and that's what we tried to do.
I think children love accumulating facts. And when you put those facts into a song, which they can learn and then regurgitate endlessly to their parents, as the parents complain to me, then the kids feel great about it.
I know a lot of people love the songs.
I mean, every time I think, oh, it's because of this, I go, oh, no, and also that and that and that. And I mean, it genuinely is the most coherent team I've ever worked with, and if one element dropped out, it wouldn't be nearly as good.
Yeah, I think you could take those songs and give them to the wrong people to perform, and they would die, despite, you know, the wonderful efforts of Richie and Dave. They are also very well performed.
Dave, I mean, it seems perhaps right at the nub of this, it's about rhythm and verse and words married to music. So are there any particular historical rhymes that you've written that you're especially proud of?
Can you imagine it? I was the last Plantagenet of Richard III. I took the rest of the day off after that, I must say. I was a bit chuffed with that one. Yeah.
Richie, do you have any particular favourites?
Well, I'm a big fan of the Monarch song, which unfortunately, due to logistical nightmare that it would be, featuring every monarch from William I right through to the Queen Elizabeth II, that song was a big challenge because that was about 11 pages long. And there's some great rhymes in that. And just the chorus building and the way that it's children can use it to learn the order of every monarch, and which they are doing. I mean, children that I know stop me in the street to sing it to me, and I think that's one I think is particularly good.
Can you give us a couple of rhyming couplets?
Well, I can try. Can everybody remember that? William, Henry, Stephen, Edward, Richard, John.
Henry, Stephen, Henry, Richard, John. Edward, Rich the...
No, yeah, what we need is a 7-year-old.
I do know it sometime.
Yeah. I mean, in one sense, the programmes look to me like they're going to be part of the great pantheon of equivalent things like Blackadder and Monty Python. Terry, did you ever think, when you sent off your first sort of Horrible Histories manuscript in the early 1990s, that you'd be sitting in the Royal Albert Hall all these years later, laughing along with actors as they perform such classics as The Plague Song or Divorced, Beheaded, Died?
I think that I could not have seen that far in the future. There wasn't a genre of comedy history around, and we created something completely new. And I used to write books in 2 or 3 book sets, a series, and they lasted a couple of years, then they vanish off the shelves. Horrible Histories has been going 18 or 19 years, and I look back at the books that started to knock me off the top. They've all long gone, and Horrible Histories has got something weird, like Blackadder and like all the classics. And I'm just so thrilled that the television has done the books justice. Mm. It would be ever so disappointing if these books, which have become in a way classics, and I'm not boasting about that, that they're read and there are now parents coming to me saying, I passed on my books to my children. And children are writing to me, I love Terrible Tudors, and that was written 10 years before they were born, you know. So they are classics. And it would be so disappointing if these millions of fans were presented with television which doesn't come up to the standard of expectations. Mm. And I'm thrilled with what television's done. And The Proms, another extension.
One of the things that I find fascinating is that in one sense there are going to be generations of children who will be growing up in the next 20, 30 years who've been brought up on a diet of horrible histories. And they're going to be setting a challenge for all those adult programme makers for the sorts of history we might see on television. What do you think is the long-term impact, though, of the books and the TV series?
For me, we started developing the series with clips of Monty Python and Do Not Adjust Your Sets and Blackadder, and we said this is the sort of thing we want to aim for. So if we're considered in the same breath as them now, then I couldn't ask for anything better. I mean, it's really incredible. But for me, I think it's any child that comes up to me and says that they've learned something from the show and it's inspired them to want to go and find out more, that's what I want to do.
Dave?
There's been a few eminent historians who've said, oh, you know, the thing about horrible histories is it's a sort of over-populist way of teaching history. And I think they've kind of missed the point completely. And I think the point that Caroline made is that a good teacher is somebody who makes you want to find out more rather than the one who gives you the most facts. And I think that I hope that that's what horrible histories does. And I think it does from the experiences that we're all finding of kids who are saying, yeah, I'm really interested in history now, thanks to having watched that programme, and they never would have been before. Recently, I went into my son's class, my son's 8 years old, and I went in and was talking to them about storytelling and how stories have beginnings, middles and ends and whatever. They've got some computers up there, and I said, this is what I do for a living sometimes. I write these songs. And so we showed them the Charles II YouTube, and even before we showed it to them, they said, oh, what? You wrote that? And it was just, I was suddenly sort of transformed from being my kid's dad to being this kind of demigod in front of these eight-year-olds. It was just phenomenal how they just were kind of completely blown away.
We're all called cool at last. It's just about 30 years too late.
The fact that I've got a generation of children going around humming Richard, my little Roy, songs for the next 20 years is very nice, thank you very much.
And listening to them in the Royal Albert Hall, ever think that would happen?
Well, you know, I've spent my life really secretly wanting to be a pop star, but to have my three chords played in the Albert Hall in nine different variations is beyond my wildest dreams. It's fantastic.
It really does seem to me, then, that horrible histories are going to create and a very significant legacy, and perhaps a legacy that will change the way people, younger people and older people, think about history. But Caroline Norris, Dave Cohen, Richie Webb and Terry Deary, thank you all very much.
Thank you. Today's 20 Minutes was presented by the historian Professor Justin Champion from Royal Holloway, University of London, and it was produced by Sarah Taylor. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for today's free family prom. Right here on stage, the TV series Horrible Histories has been coming to life before our very eyes, and there's lots more in store for us. Here comes Louise Fryer, but I think she's about to have a shock. I think some of the players are missing down there.
Welcome back. Welcome back to this Horrible Histories prom. Are you enjoying it so far?
Yeah!
Excellent. Well, in the second half, we're going to be meeting some very famous composers, and rumour has it Queen Victoria herself might be putting in an appearance, which is more than can be said for some of the members of the Aurora Orchestra. Rattus, what's going on? We can't have a prom without a full orchestra. Are they still having ice creams?
No, they're playing football in the car park. No, relax, Louise. I'm on top of it for once. The orchestra wanted to make a grand entrance. In fact, that sounds like them now.
So it does. I want to see this. I'm going to go and find a seat.
Ha!
What are you all doing here, then? Oh, hey, look! Hey, it's only my favorite conductor, Jean-Baptiste Lully. Cooey, Lully! I love you. I do. I really do.
Thank you, I think.
I love the conducting you do with a big stick, too. All this stuff. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Wee-dee-dee-dee-dee. I love it. Love it. So much classier than that other fellow with his little twig. Nee-nee-nee-nee-nee-nee-nee. Rubbish. I've got my eye on him.
Do you mind?
Ooh, sorry, maestro. If looks could kill. I'm already dead, mate. I'm already dead. Keep up.
So, which of my musical pieces do you like the most? The one you just heard, perhaps? March pour la Cérémonie Turc? Or maybe you prefer my Air de Démon?
Oh, no. Listen, I'm not a big fan of your music, mate. I mean, it's all right and all that, but I am a big fan of your stupid death.
Oh, no.
Come on, organ grinder, that was your cue. Come on. Here we go. Let's get the jingle. Come on, move it, you lot. Come on. Oh, watch it, you. Got my eye on you. Okay, you know how it goes. I'll count you in. Join in if you know the words. Here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4, stupid death, stupid death. They're funny because they're true. Stupid death, stupid death. Hope next time it's not you. Oh. Hey, I borrowed this off a friend of mine. I think it's his funny bone. Funny bone. Well, it made me laugh. Right. Let's get on with this stupid death. Come on then, Monsieur Lully, fire away. What's your story?
Well, I was the official composer to none other than the French King Louis XIV. Between 1672 and 1686, I wrote no less than 20 operas, so...
No. Well done, top of the class, swotty trousers. Now, the stupid death, if you don't mind.
Well, in 1687, to celebrate Louis XIV's recent recovery from a terrible illness, I was conducting a Te Deum.
A tedium? What's that? A spectacularly boring piece of music?
No. It's a Te Deum. It's a Latin. It means a hymn of praise.
Yeah, I know. I was being amusing. Oh, sorry, you're French. You wouldn't understand.
Do you want to hear the stupid death or not, mate?
Yeah. Duh. Obv.
Right. Well, I was beating time for the orchestra using my big staff, which I bang against the floor. You might have noticed me doing it on the way in with the...
Yes, maestro. You see, they hadn't invented tiddly little batons like yours in Lully's day, so they had to conduct using a proper big stick. Bee, 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 bee. See? Much better. Watch him. You'll learn something from him. Carry on.
So, yes, I was beating time for the music like so. Boom, 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 boom. You get the idea.
Yeah.
When I was a little bit careless and with one unfortunate stroke, I missed the floor and struck instead my own toe. Ah, not again!
That sounds almost as painful as it is funny.
Yes, well, the wound became infected, creating an abscess.
Ooh, I like where this is going.
And the abscess then developed gangrene.
Yes.
And I died.
Oh, hey, you came to a sticky end. Do you get it because of this? She gets it. Hey, maestro, don't let him near one of your little batons. He'll probably have his eye out.
Come on!
Priceless. Oh, come on then, Lully. Let's get you backstage. I want to take a look at this gangrenous toe. Exit music, please. Stupid deaths, stupid deaths. They're funny because they're true. Stupid deaths, stupid deaths. Hope next time it's not you.
Hello, guten Tag. Guten Tag, I'm Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, the greatest composer that has ever lived. I played to your King George III of England when I was just 8 years old. Can you imagine how cute?
Hello.
Excuse me, I'm talking, please. Now, where was I? I'm Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, the greatest composer that has ever lived. At the age of 11, I composed the opera Bastien at Bastien. Yes, what do you want?
Excuse me, what time does the concert start?
What?
What?
The concert's already started. We're over halfway through.
What?
I said it's already started.
What?
We're over halfway through!
Why are you whispering?
Right. You stay there. Excuse me, may I borrow this? Thank you so much. It's already started! Now, where was I? I'm Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, the greatest composer that has ever lived.
It has already started?
Yes!
Okay, you need to relax. You need to chill off, buddy, huh?
Okay.
Ooh. My name is Ludwig van Beethoven. I am the greatest composer that ever lived.
Well, this is awkward. I'm Mozart. I was greater than you.
I don't think so, Wolfie. My third symphony revolutionized music. My ninth symphony was the first to involve a singers und orchestra. And you might recognize my most famous piece of music, my fifth symphony. It goes something like this. Fa, 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 fa. You recognize that? So you stick that in your schnitzel.
Oh, yeah? Well, I composed over 600 pieces of music. Operas, duets, trios, quartets, quintets, concertos and symphonies, and all before I was 36. So you beat that, girlfriend.
I composed half my music when I was deaf.
Shall we call it a draw?
Okie dokie.
Come on, let's find you a hairbrush. I was so the greatest.
What?
Nothing, nothing. It was me. It was me.
It's absolutely true. Brilliant Beethoven got deafer and deafer as he got older. In fact, after the first performance of his Ninth Symphony, Beethoven didn't have a clue the audience were applauding until someone turned him round to face them. I thought I was going deaf once when I was living down in the sewer. Turned out I just had some poo in my ears. Well, anyway, marvellous Mozart composed this next piece when he was 30 years old. It caused quite a scandal at the time because it made servants look much cleverer and more likeable than their aristocratic masters. It's the overture to the opera Marriage of Figaro.
Thank you. It's time for my solo. Do you have any idea how long I've been waiting back there?
No, sorry, I don't, actually.
Well, ages! That's how long. Almost as long as I had to wait for my dad to die so I could become king.
Wasn't that nearly 60 years?
Well, it certainly felt that long back there, Nicholas. You remind me of someone, you know. The Duke of Chandos. Yes. I mean, not physically. He had nicer clothes and a far better wig. But he had his own orchestra like yours, except his was in his house. Yes, a full 27-piece orchestra in his house to play whatever he liked whenever he wanted. Even had his own composer, a chap called Handel. Heard of him?
Yes, I have, yes.
Whatever, mate. You met him?
No.
I have. Play something of his, if you please. He's a nice fella, Handel. He's a good bloke. Wrote some beautiful music. Yeah. This one in particular reminds me of my wife. Awful woman! Oh, seriously, Queen Caroline. She looked like an open tin of tuna. She didn't deserve me. For I am worth two of any man. Just ask my weighing scales. Yeah, all right, it's not that funny. So why did I marry her, you ask, when a stunning show pony like me could have any woman he wanted? Well, as per usual, it was my dad's fault. Let me explain. I'm George the Fourth, the Regent King, which means I was just standing in, acting king because my dad, George the Third, had gone barking mad.
Bananas!
Great palaces I did design. Buckingham was one of mine. Art and fashion I so rated.
And wives?
That's more complicated. Actresses and duchesses, the great loves of my life. I loved more girls and I ate pies, but I couldn't stand my wife.
He couldn't stand his wife.
Will you just go away? I only married Queen Caroline when my debts began to climb. 'Cause if I agreed to tie the knot,
I said I'd pay off the lot.
Didn't I? Yes, indeed, yes, indeed. But the wedding caused all sorts of strife, 'cause I already had a wife.
A divorced Catholic.
Dad did sigh, but the mad old goat just wouldn't die.
Still here.
Oh, spoke too soon. At last I killed solo, all right. As true king, my reign began. Though I was now older than your nan, and as the ruler of our nation, I banned my wife from my coronation. And knowing now that I did hate her, she promptly died just 3 weeks later. But all those pies that I got through meant 10 years later I died too.
Hello, have we met? I'm a kangaroo.
Oh no. Actresses, duchesses, the great loves of my life. I love more girls and I ate pies, but I couldn't stand my wife. I had just 10 years on the throne, do you remember that? No, all that you remember is... I was really fat.
He was really fat.
Pop off, Dad, will you? Don't applaud him. He's an embarrassment, that's what he is. So embarrassing, honestly. So, how do you intend to follow a performance like that, foul rodent?
Well, let's see. We've done medieval music from the Middle Ages.
Yep, yep.
Renaissance music from Tudor times.
Yeah.
Baroque music from when you Georgians were around.
Oh, yeah.
So I reckon it's time for romantic music. Appropriate, wouldn't you say, for following one of history's great romantics?
Flattery will get you everywhere.
This is one of history's great composers of romantic music. It is Felix Mendelssohn.
Oh, I might stick around and listen to this, then.
And probably his best-known piece of music, The Wedding March.
The Wedding March? Mm. Weddings remind me of my wife. Have you not listened to a word I've just said? I am so out of here, people. Farewell!
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 Over to you, Mr. Collins.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, rats and rattesses, there's one person we need to thank personally for today. She's responsible for the amazing building we find ourselves in. Yes, this hall, the Royal Albert Hall, was built to honour her late husband, Prince Albert. Please welcome Queen Victoria! Hang on. You're not Queen Victoria. You're Cleopatra, Queen of all Egypt.
Yeah. Well, Victoria has locked herself in the toilets. She was crying over losing her husband, Albert. It was the wedding march that set her off. Honestly, she loses one husband and she's still moping 40 years later. It's pathetic. You know, three of my husbands had been murdered by the time I was 25, and you don't see me crying about it.
Don't you normally arrive by carpet?
Yeah, I did that once when I was smuggled into Julius Caesar's palace rolled up in a rug, but I'm never doing that again. Do you have any idea how long it takes me to look this good? Can you imagine what my hair looked like after I'd been rolled out of a rug? It was a total mess. I had to wash it and wee three times before it looked good again.
Did you say we?
Yeah, that's how we cleaned our hair in ancient Egypt.
What a coincidence. We's my favourite shampoo too. You know, you and me, we've got a lot in common.
I don't think so somehow. Do you know what? Take that back or I will have you fed to the crocs.
Wow. People sure don't last long around you, do they?
No, too right they don't. Right, are we ready for some modern music? Yeah? Famous beauty coming at ya. Guys all go gaga for me, oh. I am a leader and a lady and a queen. I'm Cleopatra, such a queen never been seen. I am a pharaoh, yet pharaoh, meant to be guys, but I don't care, oh, I just wear, oh, be a disguise. My mom and dad were pharaohs, I thought my rules due. But both my older sisters thought that they should rule too. Oh dear, they both died, I wonder who that will leave. Little me, oh, pharaoh Cleo, okay, no time to grieve. Think that's alarming, you'd be right, but it gets worse. Married my half-brother and we rule the universe. That bad romance led to an overcrowded throne. But then he died, boo-hoo, so now I rule alone. Wow, 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 wow. My list of vices, bathed in ashes, milk and spices. Then I dress like goddess Isis, long black hair and ringlets nice as vipers, two for men in tices, finest linen robe, top prices. Married another brother, he's an okay geezer, but never told of my love for Julius Caesar. Had Caesar's child and hoped that he'd be crowned king. My bro said no, I said oh, and I murdered him. 'Cause I am Cleopatra, Egypt's royalty, the ruling pharaoh, don't you dare or mess with me. My poker face smiles only when I see a man who takes my fancy like, oh, Mark Antony. Whoa, 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 whoa. Whoa, 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 la, la. No Egyptian crowd pleaser. Finally, I've met my matcher. Ends in death for him and me. Oh, my life was a drama. I was one kooky mama. Whoa, 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 you know. Today, I'd be a favorite of the paparazzo. No pictures, no pictures.
That's right. Cleopatra used to wear a fake beard. Nice. But then I think everyone looks better with a hairy face. If you're listening on Radio 3, I can only remind you once again that I am a rat. You know, one of my favourite historical facts is that whilst Cleopatra's lot were busy building vast pyramids and palaces in Egypt, people in Britain were building Stonehenge. Stonehenge. Yes, ancient Egypt came at exactly the same time as the tail end of the Stone Age, which actually consisted of lots of different eras. I'll let my hairy friend over there explain in another modern style of song. Jazz!
I'm sure you've heard the Stone Age occurred for 2.5 million years. But there's more of Stone Age to engage than maybe it first appears. Hit. Dinosaurs, Neanderthals, let's make this clearer. Didn't live together, came from different eras. That's not all I can tell you, so much more to be known about the many phases of the ages of stone. Shooby dooby doo wop, it's all the rage to skiddly bop doo wah, brush up on your Stone Age. Oh yeah, alright. It's fine to define an era Paleolithic, but you're gonna have to be a little more specific. You mean lower, when ancient beings first used tools. Oh, middle Paleolithic, when Neanderthal rules. That's when Homo sapiens starts to emerge. But just in Africa, it's long before the global surge. Not till Upper Paleolithic, 40,000 years ago, did Neanderthal and Homo sapiens say hello. Neanderthal and Homo sapiens are living in a caveman harmony. Language was invented, cave painting art. Then Paleolithic ended, which meant the start of phase tooby dooby doo wop and turn a new page. Skiddly bop doo wop, mug up on your Stone Age. Oh yeah, alright. This is where it starts to get all scientific. Paleolithic's followed by the era Mesolithic. Then Neanderthals are wiped out by the Ice Age horrific. After which the Neolithic Age was terrific. Man learned to farm, build homes so they could settle. Then some other folks turned up and they discovered metal. Beaker men from Europe have outgrown and outgrown simple and traditional ways of stone. Bronze Age was invented, by now man was flying. Cause hard on its heels came the Age of Iron. Celts, Druids, religion then Rome. By now it is the memory those ages of stone. Shooby dooby doo wop since that metallic stage. Stiddly bop doo wah, there was no more Stone Age. Shooby dooby doo wop, now you know what is known about the many phases of the ages of stone. Yeah! All right!
Chewie! Guess who? Guess who? Guess who? Who is it? Who is it? Who is it? Who is it? It's me, Death! Keep up! Come on, keep up! Oh, all right, Maestro, how's it going?
Oh, very well, thanks.
Any conductors died in any stupid way since I've been gone?
Don't think so.
Oh, no. Shame. I'm only kidding, really. I'm joshing with you. I'm messing with you, Maestro. Oh, listen. I felt I was a bit harsh on you earlier, so to make sure there's no hard feelings, I brought you a little prezi. Ah. Yeah, it's Jean-Baptiste Lully's gangrenous toe.
Thank you.
No, no need to thank me. You're welcome. It's totally fine. Totally fine. I kill me, I do. I really do. Now, listen, Maestro. Where's your flute players?
Right over there.
Flute players. Ah, there we are. Because I want to try something, because, you know, one of my favourite musical instruments comes from the Stone Age, you know. It does. It really does. Let's have a look at your... May I have a look at your flute, please? Yeah, see, it's a bit blingy, isn't it? It's a bit ooh in your face. It's a bit booyakasha, isn't it? How long have you had this flute? 6 months, yeah. I've had this flute 43,000 years. Yeah, it's a Stone Age flute made from hollowed out leg bone. Woo! Let's compare them, shall we? Give us a little blast on your flute there. Yeah, but you're all right, that'll do. No need to show off. Just because your mates are here. Now try this Stone Age flute. Yeah? Sorry, keep it on. Bit embarrassing, isn't it? So a Neanderthal from 40,000 BC can play that, but you can't, eh? Not so big in front of your mates now, are you? I'll leave that with you to practice with. Keep up the hard work. You might even get on radio with a bit of luck. Now, we've been on a wonderful journey today, haven't we? Through the history of music. You know, from the Middle Ages to modern music, via a little trip back to the Stone Age. So I thought, what better way to end the show than with the most horrible piece of music ever? That's right, it's Jedward. I'm joking, I'm pulling your legs off. No. They came a close second. No, I'm talking about a piece of music by Russian composer Igor Stravinsky. It's called The Rite of Spring. And when it was first performed in 1913, it was considered so outrageous that the audience rioted. Woo! Well, I hope that doesn't happen today. I do hope that happens. I love a good riot. It's about a dancer who danced herself to death. Sounds like a job for me. We'll be right back.
grabbed this from to bring you breaking news that Vikings have invaded the Royal Albert Hall.
Ooh, did someone say an invasion? Ooh, I love a good invasion.
No. This is not good. The Vikings are invading. They're nearly here.
Ooh, I can't wait.
For your own safety, ladies and gentlemen, please keep your heads down to avoid any flying axes.
Oh, don't be such a spoilsport. Hey, Maestro, play them something they can invade by. How about Wagner's The Ride of the Valkyries?
Are there any monks in the crowd?
Not for long! All right!
I'll kill you. Let's do this thing. What's the song of 793? When we sailed across the great North Sea.
Comets crossed the skies that night. You must have known something wasn't right.
You arrived upon your English shore, and you offered friendship, but we wanted more. Yes, much more. We're tearing up this place tonight.
Literally!
We're gonna set this sleepy town alight.
Literally!
We'll kill and steal and burn and drink, cause us Viking don't care what you think. Primed and ready to attack.
And we love how monks just don't fight back.
You'll die or become a slave to me.
Though our slave doesn't get jumped in the sea. Yeah. If the boat's heavy, yeah, yeah.
You're gonna lose your head, my friend.
Literally.
We're gonna get you in the end.
Literally.
Oh!
Vikings!
And that's how we roll.
Play that axe, Ragnar!
But in a good way. And now it's time to say goodbye in true horrible history style.
People we need to thank for that. First of all, let's thank the Horrible Histories crew and their fabulous dancers.
And give it up for the choirs from the Music Centre and the Kids Company Choir.
Let's thank the wonderful Aurora Orchestra.
Our conductor for the evening, Mr. Nicholas Collins.
And our signer, Paul Whittaker. And your host, Rattus Rattus.
Of course, the lovely Louise Fryer.
And you, our wonderful audience. Thank you and goodbye.
And goodbye to Rattus and Louise. As the applause continues here at the Royal Albert Hall, I'll say goodbye too and hand you on now to David Cornett in Broadcasting House.
Well, too many presenters to name there at the Royal Albert Hall, but we can name our own Sarah Walker, and I hope she was dancing and singing with the rest of them.
The Proms is, as we know, the world's greatest festival of music, stretching from now to September like a note that's held and held and held. And I reckon the Proms Poetry Competition is one of the world's greatest poetry competitions, stretching your imagination from now to the closing date of August the 6th. What we'd like you to do is write a poem in any style, on a piece of music that's performed at this year's Proms. You can react to the music in all sorts of ways. It could evoke a memory. It could make you feel something abstract and profound. Or you could pen a sonnet on the way the conductor moves on the podium in the same way your Auntie Mabel moved as she hung out her washing. There are three age groups, 7 to 11, 11 to 18, and 18 upwards. I'm the judge, along with the former Children's Laureate, Michael Rosen, and I can't wait to read your entries.
And you can read more about the competition on the Radio 3 website. Well, this is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. We're running a little bit late. It's 16 minutes past one, and high time for the news from Ian Skelly.
The head of Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs has admitted their service simply wasn't good enough last year. Mike Clasper was responding to a report by a committee of MPs who said the tax office didn't answer phone calls or respond to letters quickly enough. He said morale was at rock bottom, but he said things were improving. Libyan rebels have said their military commander was killed by an Islamic-linked militia. General Yunus was shot inside rebel territory earlier this week, but it's been unclear by whom. Colonel Gaddafi's regime said the killing proved the opposition were not capable of running the country. American troops serving in Afghanistan have been warned that they may not get paid if their country's debt crisis isn't resolved. US politicians have until Tuesday to increase the country's debt ceiling. During a tour of Afghanistan, Admiral Mike Mullen was asked by soldiers if their wages were guaranteed, but he said he couldn't honestly answer the question. The US government agency that deals with reconstruction in Iraq says the country is more dangerous now than a year ago. A report said the killing of US soldiers and the assassination of senior Iraqi figures had recently increased. 15 American soldiers were killed in Iraq last month. The Metropolitan Police has said they're investigating alleged computer hacking by newspapers as well as phone hacking. The operation began in response to claims made by the BBC's Panorama programme in March. A British tourist has died after falling from a third-floor balcony in Ibiza. The incident happened yesterday. The Foreign Office said they're helping the man's family. And in just under 2 hours' time, the wedding of the Queen's granddaughter, Zara Phillips, will begin in Edinburgh. Miss Phillips, the daughter of Princess Anne, is marrying the England rugby player Mike Tyndall. The ceremony will take place at Canongate Kirk on the Royal Mile. And the weather, a dry afternoon for almost all of the UK with some sunny spells. The highest temperatures will be 21 degrees Celsius across England. And that's the BBC News, the time approaching 20 past one.
And time for today's early music show. Here's Catherine Bott.
400 years ago, France was plunged into a month and a half of mourning. Le bon roi Henri, Henry the Great, the gallant King Henry IV of France, was dead. The day after the king's death, his body was eviscerated, his entrails sent to the Basilica of Saint-Denis, and his heart placed in a heart-shaped silver casket for transportation to the College of Jesuits at La Flèche, a journey marked by solemn ceremonies in every town and city on the way. The royal corpse was then embalmed and lay in state in the Louvre Palace until the end of June, when it was transported from the Louvre to Notre-Dame in sombre but magnificent procession. Here's a contemporary account. On Tuesday, the 29th of the month, the streets from the Louvre to the Church of Notre-Dame were draped in black on either side, and upon those hangings were set the king's coat of arms and that of the city of Paris, with about an ell between them, and torches blazed on every house front. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the cortege set forth.
Thank you.
Lutenist Lutz Kirchhoff played Courante de la Reine by Robert Ballard, and before that, Pavane pour le Roi from the Philidor manuscript, performed by Douce Mémoire, directed by Denis Raisin d'Adre. Music from the time of Henri IV of France, who died untimely 400 years ago. The day after the king's body was taken to Notre Dame, the cathedral was the backdrop to a mass celebrated in the king's honour. The whole service lasted 5 hours and was followed by a 7-hour procession of the cortège to the Basilica of Saint-Denis, where it arrived at 10 o'clock for further vespers and vigils. Then, on the 1st of July, another funeral ceremony was held at Saint-Denis from 9 a.m. until 2 in the afternoon. Such splendid funeral rites received, as you've already heard, a lavish contemporary account, full of incidental detail about the coffin within a coffin, the cloth of gold draperies and heraldic devices, the ringing of the bells. It also states, helpfully, that the musicians included the members of every royal musical establishment, with shawms, flutes, trumpets, drums and so on, all of them draped in black. The only thing that isn't mentioned is, what music did they play? Material by the composer Eustache du Corroy is likely to have featured heavily in the proceedings. He'd been in the king's service for more than 20 years, first as deputy master of the Chapel Royal, then as composer to the Royal Chamber and superintendent of the king's music. Du Corroy's only surviving mass is his Missa pro Defunctis, written in 1606, which was the most famous requiem mass of its day. French tradition declares that it was this mass that was sung at Henri IV's funeral. More than a century later, in 1724, it was confirmed as the official requiem to be sung at funerals of all kings of France. Movements from the Missa pro defunctis by Eustache du Corroy, probably performed at the funeral of Henri IV of France, and performed on that recording by members of the ensemble Douce Mémoire. Well, kings have always had grand funerals, but this tremendous display of national mourning would seem to indicate that Henri's life had been a significant one. So let's hear the story. Henri de Bourbon was born on the 13th of December 1553, and although he was baptised a Catholic, he was raised as a Protestant when his mother declared that Calvinism was now the official religion of Navarre. At 19, he became King of Navarre, and 2 months later was married to Marguerite de Valois, daughter of King Henri II and Catherine de Médicis. It was a dynastic rather than a love match, of course, and the actual ceremony had tragic consequences. Huge numbers of French Protestants, Huguenots, came to Paris for the wedding and were then butchered in the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, popularly believed to have been instigated by the young king's new mother-in-law, Catherine de Médicis. So Henri started his reign and married life in hiding. He stuck to his faith, though, and when he became the official heir to the French throne in 1584, a complicated story involving Salic law and the impossibility of a female succession, this sparked off the War of the Three Henrys, in which King Henry III had Henry of Guise murdered, only to be assassinated himself. Once again, our Henry survived the bloodshed, and he was crowned King of France in 1589. And to cut a long sectarian story short, this is the Early Music Show, not the History of French Kings show, after all, he decided eventually to renounce Protestantism in order to gain control of Paris and reign with authority over his country. Yes, he's the man who allegedly said, "Paris is well worth a mass." Henri is often referred to as Henry the Great, or Good King Henry. Perhaps the most revealing nickname for him is Le Vert Galant, the Green Gallant, a nod to his all-round dashing chivalry and attractiveness to women. That first arranged marriage to Marguerite was unhappy, childless and annulled, and although he sired 3 children with the love of his life, Gabrielle d'Astrée, marriage was not an option, and her death in 1599 cleared the way for him to marry Maria de Medici.
Sue, la bella sposa.
Jill Feldman and lutenist Nigel North with an aria from Peri's opera Euridice, written to celebrate the marriage of Henry IV of France and Maria de Medici. His second marriage and a second involvement with the Medici family, producing a work that's reckoned to be the second ever opera. France could relax under the genial rule of Henri le Grand. Instead of subduing contentious aristocrats with the sword, he paid them off. He was keen to ease the lives of all his subjects, which made him very popular. Another of his alleged sayings: "If God spares me, I will ensure that there is no working man in my kingdom who does not have the means to have a chicken in the pot of a Sunday."